Okay, so I'm going to be talking about three-way fight politics and Trump's authoritarianism. So this is the three-way fight book. Subtitle is Revolutionary Politics and Anti-Fascism. This came out last year, co-published by PM Press and Chris Blebedeb. And it includes a number of essays and interviews and kind of position statements going back several decades. Some of them were published on the Three-Way Fight blog and website, and others are from other sources. And I co-edited it with Christian Alexander, who is another long, he was really the founder of the Three-Way Fight website. And then this is my previous book, Insurgent Supremacists, the U.S. Far Right's Challenge to State and Empire, also co-published by PM Press and Chris Blebedeb. So Trump's authoritarianism, there's obviously a lot we could say about it, but I think you know what I'm talking about when I refer to that. Three-way fight politics may not be so obvious what it means, and so I want to just start by kind of explaining that in brief, and then talk about how it can help us to understand what's going on, what Trump has been doing over the past decade or more, how we got to this point, and you know, what we're dealing with, what we face in terms of threats and possibilities. So in a very brief nutshell, the basic idea of three-way fight is as an idea that comes out of the radical anti-fascist movement, that on the one hand, there are forces of fascism and the far right more broadly that represent a particular kind of threat. And that is one struggle. And then there is a struggle for various kinds of systemic change because of the oppressive, exploitative society that we live in. And those two struggles are related to each other. They're very much interconnected, but they're not the same struggle. And to some extent, they involve confronting different enemies. And to some extent, they involve developing different strategies. So that's, you know, as I say, just in a very brief nutshell, that's what three-way fight is about. It's about saying we can't just think of this as a two-sided conflict. You know, traditionally, anti-fascism has, you know, there's tended to be a couple of different pitfalls that it falls into. On the one side, you have the sort of liberal notion that fighting fascism is about defending the democratic mainstream against the extremes on both the right and the left. And among other problems, you know, first and foremost is just the fact that, you know, the United States has never been a democracy. I mean, not just it isn't a democracy now, but it has never been a democracy. And equating the extremes of the right and the left is just fundamentally misunderstanding what those currents are about and just the fundamental disconnect between them. And then on the left, there's another kind of pitfall, which has tended to look at fascism as essentially a tool or representation or project of the ruling class. And, you know, yes, I mean, there's definitely a relationship there. There's a way that fascism has historically defended and upheld class society and has worked together with capitalists in order to gain power and to attack the left and working class and oppressed communities. But there's also important ways that fascism has clashed with ruling class interests. And that's important to understand. And so we can't simply say, you know, they're all working together or they're all pushing or pulling in the same direction. So three-way fight politics says we need to take seriously what the far right says, what it does, not simply treat them as tools, as, you know, opportunists, as people who are just covering for big business or something like this, but look at the particularities of their political projects, recognize that there are real human beings who are attracted to these movements based on human hopes and fears, and recognize that there are differences within the far right, and that those differences are important, not just in some sort of abstract intellectual sense, but because they can point to potential tensions and fissures that we need to know about in order to combat them more effectively. And then also that far-right politics doesn't stand still. You know, fascism in 2025 looks very different from fascism in 1985, let alone fascism in 1935. And being able to understand how those changes happen over decades or years, or in some cases, weeks or months, that's also important for, again, not just intellectual understanding, but for strategic reasons. So let me say a little bit about Trump and his movement. I mean, Donald Trump started his first campaign for the Republican presidential nomination 10 years ago, 2015. It was for the 2016 election. And over this past decade, he has had a huge impact, obviously, but the character of his political project has changed over time. His relationship with far-right politics has changed over time. And the character of his political coalition has also changed over time. This movement that he's built didn't come out of nowhere. Obviously, it builds on past organizing and activism and propaganda that right-wingers have been carrying out for many years within the Republican Party and outside of it. And part of his skill has been the ability to identify key issues or key themes that are effective in attracting support and holding support, whereas others have, you know, risen and fallen in various ways. There are a number of different currents within the Trump coalition that are worth just kind of highlighting briefly. You have white nationalists, you have Christian nationalists, you have the Patriot movement, you have conventional conservatives. There's a lot of different forces here. And each of these has a different ideology and a different relationship with Trump and with what he's trying to do. So white nationalists, for example, and when I say white nationalists, I don't just mean people who are racist, but people who literally want to create an all-white nation, whether that means by breaking away from the U.S. They used to talk about going to the Pacific Northwest as, you know, kind of an enclave that they would create, you know, something like that, or overthrowing the government, but, you know, creating an all-white nation. And white nationalists have, over time, had, I would say, a very kind of ambivalent relationship with Trump. They've seen him as somebody who is useful to their cause and somebody who was promoting certain things that were in line with their politics, but in other ways was out of line with what they were trying to do. And so at different points, you've seen white nationalists being more enthusiastic or less enthusiastic about Trump. And that's, you know, that's worth paying attention to. Christian nationalists, this is folks in a number of Protestant and to some extent Catholic-based organizations. I would say the most important and dangerous of which is what's known as the New Apostolic Reformation movement. It's a whole network of different organizations. These are folks who want to create a theocracy, want to turn the United States into a theocracy. And unlike white nationalists, they don't put race at the center of their politics. That doesn't mean they aren't racist, but that's not what it's all built around. For them, it's built around putting their version of Christianity in charge. And in practical terms, that tends to mean that they put gender and sexuality at the center rather than race. And New Apostolic Reformation, although it upholds a lot of racist policies, it has also built a movement that is genuinely multi-ethnic and multiracial, including with people of color and women in some fairly high leadership positions. So again, this is important for us to understand in order to combat it more effectively. Patriot movement started in the 1990s, roughly, around what we used to call citizen militias. These are folks who developed in response to, you know, fears that there was some kind of globalist conspiracy to impose a dictatorship on the United States. They're really big on conspiracy theories. They're very hostile to centralized government. There's a whole branch of the Patriot movement that rejects any kind of government above the county level as illegitimate. There's another branch that says that each person is their own sovereign. It's a sovereign citizens movement, so that, you know, any kind of notion of government at all is sort of meaningless. Patriot movement folks, again, they tend to uphold racist policies, but not in explicitly racist terms a lot of the time. They often present it as colorblindness. You know, we don't see color. And, you know, Oath Keepers would prominently display black people on, you know, as members, black members, you know, on their website to show their inclusiveness. Or Proud Boys, which is sort of a close cousin of the Patriot movement. They talked about Western chauvinism. So it's like upholding European cultural supremacy, but in a way that was inclusive of at least some men of color. And Enrique Tarrio, for example, longtime head of the Proud Boys, identifies as a man of color. And then you have conventional conservatives who don't necessarily believe in any kind of supremacism in explicit terms, but have historically upheld conventional themes such as reducing government interference in the economy and opposing affirmative action, opposing wokeism, and so on. And there's been a kind of convergence where conventional conservatives have tended to embrace various themes coming from far-right movements increasingly over time, such as, for example, anti-immigration policies. 40 years ago, anti-immigration policies was not a major theme at all for conventional conservatives, but it has become one. Yeah, again, part of Trump's strength has been his ability to kind of wield together these various forces. And it's not that all of them necessarily agree with everything that he advocates or everything that he's doing, but to a greater or lesser extent, they have lent their support and have set aside their differences in the interest of furthering their common goals or furthering goals that they see as beneficial for their particular movements. And then you get a kind of cross-fertilization between them, where you get white nationalist themes that start intersecting and being in dialogue with themes from some of these other forces. And I'm giving a very broad brush picture. There's a lot of different versions of each of these, and there's other themes that come into play. But just to give a sense that, you know, again, we're not dealing with just one ideology or one set of politics, but there's a number of different threads. And then in terms of change over time, Trump's relationship with the organized far right and far right ideology has really changed over this past decade. When he started out, he was, you know, he was very much working within the Republican Party, but doing it in a way that was explicitly hostile to the Republican establishment. I mean, he was attacking liberals, but he was also attacking mainstream conservatives. You know, a lot of his early polemics in the Republican parties were hostile to the Bushes and the other kind of establishment conservatives who've been running the party for a long time. And this is a lot of what made him appealing to forces on the far right, as well as a lot of folks who just felt pretty alienated from politics in general. But in his 2016 campaign, he developed a kind of symbiotic relationship with the organized far right in a way that was unprecedented. And specifically with the alt-right, which I would identify as a sort of particular branch of the far right that was mostly white nationalist, but kind of blended white nationalism with a particularly virulent kind of misogyny coming from the manosphere subculture, and then focused on online organizing and online activism as opposed to, you know, kind of conventional, historical, in-person organizing. Anyway, the alt-right mostly supported Trump in 2016 and significantly helped him by attacking his opponents within the Republican Party and then in the general election. And in return, they got a lot of validation and increased coverage and increased legitimacy based on that relationship. So again, it was a symbiotic kind of relationship that we had not seen before in U.S. politics, as far as I'm aware. After Trump was elected, the alt-right largely became disenchanted with him. They saw him as kind of selling out, to a large extent, to the political establishment. They were very disappointed with a lot of what he was doing. And keep in mind, in that first administration, Trump was in a much weaker position. He had to bring in a lot of establishment figures and had much less ability to impose his particular wishes on even his own administration than he does now. And then you had the 2020 election, Trump lost. You had the Stop the Steal movement saying, actually, we won. This was stolen from us. You had January 6th, a mass effort to overturn the results of the election by force. And what this, to my mind, represented in part was taking a core idea from far-right politics that says the existing political system is illegitimate, taking that idea and bringing it into the mainstream in a way that had not happened before. When you say to people, the election that just happened was fraudulent, you're saying this electoral system as it is practiced is illegitimate. And we need to, if we can, actually physically overthrow it. So that was another turning point, I would say. It obviously didn't succeed in overturning that election, but it did have an important effect in terms of shifting the character of the Republican Party, in terms of shifting the character of Trump's base to a certain extent. I mean, it wasn't something, I mean, Trump had said this before, but it took in a new way in 2021 and in the years that followed, so that increasingly you had tens of millions of people who saw the electoral system as something that was invalid and illegitimate. And really, it was just about what can we do to get the results that we want. You know, in 2021, I was not expecting Trump to make the kind of comeback that he did. I mean, maybe there were people who saw that coming, but it did not look that, you know, particularly likely. By 2024, Trump's making his comeback, and not only does he gain the nomination again, but he gains control of the Republican Party in a way that had not happened before. In 2016, or even in 2020, the Republican Party was still an institution that had different political currents within it. There was a significant vocal section of Republicans who maybe they would vote for Trump, but they didn't agree with a lot of what he was saying, and they were willing to say that openly. By the end of 2024, that was not true anymore. They pushed people out. They intimidated people into silence. They imposed basically loyalty oaths on people working for the campaign, for the Republican Party, and in effect on anybody who was going to take any sort of leadership role within the Republican Party. So before trying to impose a dictatorship of the United States, Trump consolidated power within the Republican Party. And then this year, we've seen the most recent stage where, from day one, Trump has worked very quickly and systematically to try to bring about a dictatorship. We're not there yet. If we were, we wouldn't be holding this in an open forum like this. It would be a lot more difficult. But they're certainly trying to do that, trying to bring that change about. So it's partly about suppressing dissent, both through use of direct government force as well as intimidation of various kinds. It's also about expanding the power of the presidency, seizing power from other branches of government. It's about remaking the administrative state, not just cutting people. I mean, it's partly cutting, but it's remaking this the administrative state so that instead of being kind of this independent bureaucracy, it is something that is very much directly subordinate to the president. And the aim is to make all of those people personally loyal to the president. So there's a whole big transformation. And so coming back to the theme of this talk, again, this is about taking elements of far-right politics, so fascists and other kinds of far-right politics, and gradually and incrementally bringing them into the mainstream, first in terms of ideas and propaganda and so on, and then in terms of structural change. And, you know, another way to think of it is, traditionally, there's been this kind of dividing line between the far right and the mainstream right, and they've kind of dismantled that. You know, there's much more of a flow back and forth between the two. It's not that there's completely merged. You still have an independent far-right scene and movement to some extent that is independent and is sometimes critical of Trump, sometimes critical of what his administration is doing, but is largely supportive and is certainly not in any position to represent a significant challenge to it. It's more that there's a different kind of symbiotic relationship now. So for example, something that we started to see, and I think we may see more of it, is you have ICE agents and other government forces who are carrying out raids and seizing people and so on. And then you're also seeing non-governmental people sometimes presenting themselves as ICE agents. So it's like they can use that as an opportunity to do their own thing, which is an opportunity for them, but it also means if they do stuff that is embarrassing for the government, I'm not sure what that would be, but there's a kind of deniability there. You know, so it can be a useful division of labor. A couple other things. I want to say a little bit about Trump's relationship with the ruling class, and then I want to talk a little bit about points of vulnerability. So 2016 was unusual. One of the ways the 2016 election was unusual is that it was the first time since 1964 that the bulk of big business support went to the Democrats, not to the Republicans. You know, so this notion that Trump is just like he's just representing the ruling class, that's really not the case. Hillary Clinton got a lot more big business support than Trump did. Didn't win her the election. I mean, her efforts to curry favor with big business may have cost her the election, but Trump did have some business support, obviously. It tended to be very fragmented. It wasn't like they were all kind of agreeing on a certain set of policies. You had people who wanted free trade, you had people who didn't want free trade, you had companies that were very supportive of the anti-immigration policies, others that were not, different politics on military intervention, different things like this. So there wasn't this kind of cohesiveness. And this is one of the reasons, I mean, there's other reasons, but part of the reason that you saw a lot of zigzagging in the first Trump term, sudden changes of direction. After 2020, and especially after January 6, business support for Trump really took a nosedive. And it is impressive that he was able to rebuild that in 2024, which he did. And this time around, it has looked different. And I think one of the things that is notable to me is the role that the big tech capitalists have played. Inauguration Day, you had, you know, these tech billionaires sitting front and center, pride of place, representing a new kind of central role that their sector of big business holds within Trump's coalition. And Elon Musk obviously playing a leading role, but then also you have a lot of folks associated with Peter Thiel, who is another tech billionaire. J.D. Vance, for example, Vice President Vance, is a former Thiel employee and a you know, somebody who has been very heavily supported by Thiel. So there's a lot of other connections there. So this kind of central role for a particular sector of big business provides a kind of unity that you didn't see in terms of business support for Trump in the past. All right, last part, and then I will open it up for questions and hopefully discussion, you know, comments. I'd like to hear your thoughts as well. I want to say a bit about some of what I see as points of vulnerability and potential weaknesses in the Trump regime and the Trump coalition. I don't want to exaggerate this. This is a very grim time. I mean, they are in a powerful position, but it's not an invulnerable position. And in addition to the kind of potential for resistance and opposition from outside, there are fault lines within the regime that I think are important for us to look at. Something that I wrote about recently, it just came out as a pamphlet. I did this on the Three Way Fight website. It's called The Doge and the Neo-Reactionaries. So this is looking at the ideological forces behind Musk's Doge, you know, Department of Government Efficiency, so-called. Neo-reactionaries are a particular ideological current that is, it's been around for about 15, 20 years, and it's kind of rooted in the Silicon Valley scene, computer technology scene, but have promoted a very anti-democratic concept of politics. Neo-reactionary, referring to the idea that we need to go back to pre-French Revolution concepts of social hierarchy and political disenfranchisement. These folks, who sort of laid out a lot of the blueprint for what Doge has been doing, are very explicitly elitist. They're anti-populist. And that puts them in tension, in a certain way, with the MAGA movement, which is, among its other characteristics, a populist movement in the sense that it feeds on and promotes a kind of hostility to elites. Now, it has a very twisted notion of elites, and it takes that anti-elitism and directs it in poisonous ways. But when they talk about the globalists or when they talk about the establishment and so on, they're talking about powerful, wealthy people who they see as illegitimately in charge and want to displace. That's a very different notion of politics from the neo-reactionary. So this sort of elitism versus populism, I think, is one point of tension within the Trump regime or the Trump coalition that could come back to bite them, especially as the impact of what Doge is doing and what the regime is doing start to be felt among Trump supporters. There are a few other points of tension. I mean, certainly the whole push for increased tariffs that Trump has been promoting is something that, well, I mean, there are some business interests that support it, but it's certainly not most of the capitalist class or big business in the larger sense. I mean, if you took a poll of Wall Street or Fortune 500 CEOs, I don't think most of them would be in favor of what he's doing. And if you're trying to impose a dictatorship, alienating a large section of the ruling class it's not necessarily the most smart tactical move. Now, it's not a deal breaker. He may still be able to do it, but that is a potential point of weakness there. And then there are things like the lingering tension between, I mean, neoliberalism in the broader sense and America First, not just in terms of trade, but even in terms of immigration. I mean, remember the Koch brothers, Charles and David Koch? Yeah, they were kind of the bogeyman of, leftist visions of the capitalist far right not too long ago. Koch brothers have never supported Trump. Well, one of them's dead now, but Charles Koch, their political network has always upheld a much more kind of classically neoliberal notion of free trade and relatively open immigration policies against America First policies. So that theme is still there, even if it's not represented in the Trump administration. It's still there in the Republican Party. And then you have tensions between interventionist and anti-interventionist foreign policy, and those are represented. I mean, you have somebody like Tulsi Gabbard, former Democrat, former Bernie Sanders supporter, turned darling of the alt-right, who is now Trump's director of national intelligence. Very different notion of what the U.S. should be doing in the world compared to somebody like Marco Rubio, who is relatively in line with conventional sort of Republican interventionism. You know, and you could look at other players, but again, there's tensions there. Somebody like Tucker Carlson, not in government, but still very influential, somebody who Trump pays attention to. Tucker Carlson is very critical of a lot of the kinds of interventionist policies that people within Trump's own circles advocate. So there's, again, there's some points there. Now, this is not all to say that, okay, well, we can just sort of pick a side in these conflicts, but we should know about them. We should try to understand them and think about ways that we can use them as opportunities to speak to people and promote not sort of our version of supremacist politics, but liberatory politics that address people's concerns and needs in positive ways. I don't have a formula for doing that, and that's not really the scope of, you know, what I'm trying to do here, but I think that's an important part of the kind of discussion that, you know, we should be trying to have.
I remember when there was a lot of enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders. Jeffrey St. Clair in Counterpunch said that the Sandernistas, as he dubbed the Sanders supporters, were better than Sanders. And I think that's true, right? I'm not somebody who's ever voted for either of the twin parties of capitalism, but I know that a lot of people voted for Sanders because he brought the word socialism back into the mainstream. I think a lot of the far right support of Trump was similar. They recognized him as a scam artist in some ways. They weren't necessarily comfortable with him palling around with Kenya or having a Jewish son-in-law, but he allowed them to crawl out of the sewers. He allowed them to become respectable on some level and broadcast their views in the mainstream and recruit. I also think that Trump is not a true fascist himself. He's what I would call a Bonapartist. What he aspires to is a certain sort of authoritarianism, but it's something more like a Central America junta, something where he's the great man at the center of it all and everyone's going to kowtow to him. So there is this tension in this alliance, I would agree. I think what we have to be wary of on the left is that the reason why a lot of populist right-wing types supported him in the Rust Belt, et cetera, is because he was saying something that's true, that the system's broken. He was calling attention to the fact that the twin parties of capitalism control the electoral framework in such a way that there is never change that actually could benefit the masses of people. And, you know, when I look at it, I think the scary thing about this year compared to 8 years ago is the lesson that Trump took away was that the bureaucracy within the government, the professional civil service class, and I'm a 26-year civil servant in state government, knows how to kill bad policy ideas when they oppose them at the grassroots level, knows how to send something back to committee or to have a regulation reviewed or to send an inspector out to something. And I think that's why he brings in an outsider like Elon Musk, who doesn't have an official government title, to gut the whole thing. And when I look at what should the resistance be, I think for the real Nazis, the real fascists, it means confrontation. It means shutting them down when they demonstrate, not by calling for banning free speech, but by denying them the platform, by physically being up there and confronting them. And then I think we need the unions, even though the unions have been gutted, but the public sector is the one place where the unions still have a toehold. They have to get rid of the bureaucracy that kowtows to the Democrats, that votes and endorses the Democrats no matter what, and take action to resist the cuts that are happening right now by threatening to strike. And we're so paralyzed in the sense that we have so many laws in the United States against public sector unions striking. But it takes wildcats to overturn those kind of laws and to take action. And then finally, I think we have to oppose Trump not by linking ourselves to the Democratic Party and saying we just need a return to electoral politics as normal. I'm frankly shocked that the Democrats have not been more of a safety valve and not been offering more opposition. And it just shows how brittle the whole thing is. I mean, they're saying, oh, he's cutting funds for the Ukrainian war. It's horrible. It's like, is this supposed to actually appeal to people? So I'm glad that tactic is falling on its face. But that's the fear, is that things just get looped into the Democratic Party again. And that's what we have to resist.
Thank you. If I could just respond to a couple of things. So in terms of the question of, is Trump a fascist? It's a complex question. It's not the most important question in that I think whatever your position is on that, it's more important to resist. But it is something that can be useful in it to explore. And then in terms of, you know, how to carry out the resistance and what its relationship with the Democratic Party should be. I very much agree that it would be disastrous to look to the Democratic Party to lead the resistance. I mean, there are people within the Democratic Party who are standing up in positive ways, and there are certainly Democrats who can play positive roles, but it would be, I mean, first of all, structurally, the party is not going to do it. But even if it did, it would be channeling it back into this kind of dead-end system. And it is important for us to look to spheres outside of the Democratic Party and not beholden to the Democratic Party to develop forms of resistance. I mean, I think it's got to be a broad effort with many different forces. I hope that unions can play a leading role. I mean, I think the labor movement has been badly weakened over the last several decades, but it is still a significant force, and I think there's some real potential there.
When I think about current politics in 2025, in the back of my mind, I've been wondering so far, the different factions that so far have supported Trump to get this far, for example, Christian nationalists and white nationalists, many Christian nationalists aren't white, and I'm sure some of those people who claim themselves to be president-loving, God-fearing Christians have been indiscriminately deported. So maybe do you think it's possible that the snake will eat its own tail?
Say a little more. What do you mean?
If the Trump supporters physically attack each other enough, will his popular support be weak enough to do themselves in? Is there a chance for that, or does it need to be more?
I would hesitate. I think it would be a mistake to rely on that. I mean, I think it's possible that, there's certainly possible that there could be some conflict within the movement, but we should definitely not rely on that. I think it's very important that people organize direct and active resistance. It's certainly possible that he will lose more support. It's possible that there will be more infighting. I think he has time and again been pretty effective at keeping that in bounds. I think if he were to die, and he's not the youngest and probably not the healthiest guy, so he might not live out his term, then things might unravel much more. But even so, what are we going to be left with? you know, who would take his place? What kind of policies would there be? I mean, I think there's very much a need for our side to advocate for radical liberatory alternatives so that people who are just angry and confused have something to gravitate toward other than, oh, well, this guy claims to be supporting the working class, so therefore let's go with him. All right, I think we're going to close there. Thank you, everybody.